Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And, of course, we have to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But we sort of ask you to hold your calls for a few minutes, because we're going to be trying to get our special guest for this evening on the radio program. And, of course, it's going to be Joel Skousen, who's certainly one of my favorites, and I hope he's one of your favorites as well. And then, of course, second hour, we wanted to talk a little bit about some of the things we talked about last night, when we had Michael Rupert on, and Mike is a fascinating guest. But I was a little concerned with this idea that we're just running out of oil, or we're running out of natural gas. Because this is the basic theme of the people, the establishment people, Club of Rome people, the Marie Strongs of this world, who are saying, gee, we've got to lower our living standards and get rid of a lot of people, because, of course, we're running out of natural resources. So on the second hour, we're going to have with us Lindsay Williams. And Lindsay Williams, of course, worked up on the North Slope of Alaska when they were doing their drilling up there. Certainly one of my favorite guests, and I think he'll be yours as well. And I think that we need to evaluate what's going on. And, of course, I know that Michael Rupert went over to Paris, and they had this conference there. They called it peak oil. In other words, oil production is actually peaked out, and from here on it's going to be downhill as the world runs out of oil. But many of the people who are at that conference and giving the talks are part of this whole complex who want to be able to justify taking away our freedom in the name of, well, gee, we're running out of oil, and the Chinese are going to use up all the oil, and the Malaysians are going to use up all the oil, and we're just going to have to begin lowering our living standards, you know, because, well, what other alternative do we have? And I'd like to suggest that we're not being told the truth, and I suspect that that conference was designed to mislead a lot of people. Anyway, the decision is going to be yours. Last night you heard Michael, who I like and I admire and I respect, and I think he's very honest. He's done a lot of good work. But tonight you're going to hear Lindsay Williams. You're going to hear the other side of the story, and Lindsay has some fascinating, fascinating information as well. And so we're sort of hoping that between the two, why we can arrive closer at the truth. Now, what should we be doing? Well, I'll tell you, one of the things we ought to be doing is going nuclear, and I know that that's just going to get everybody upset. But nuclear energy, contrary to what was said last night, is the cheapest form of electricity. I mean, you can produce it for only a fraction of what you can actually produce it with natural gas, or even certainly with oil. And the reason it's expensive is because the environmentalists, when they tried to put in the nuclear power plant down at Diablo Canyon, why they held that thing up for about 15 years, and they ran the price up from, I think, $200 or $300 million up to several $1 billion, $4 or $5 billion, simply by harassment and lawsuits and demonstrations and sabotage and everything else imaginable, because they don't want nuclear power. And why don't they? Because they're financed by the people who control the big oil. I mean, the whole environmental movement is funded by the people from the other side who don't want a solution. They want a problem. And, of course, at least until now, why they've done everything they could to discourage development of nuclear material. Now, they say, well, oh, but, you know, what are we going to do with all of the leftover, depleted uranium? And I'm not talking about that they put in the shells. I'm talking about the fuel rods and the other, of course, fuel that they have. And I would ask you simply, well, what do they do in France, and what do they do in Germany, and what do they do in Japan with their depleted nuclear fuel, not depleted uranium, but nuclear fuel? And that is, they reprocess it. We're not allowed to do that. In America, we developed the technology, but because they don't want a solution, they blocked efforts to reprocess it. And the fact that the average American doesn't understand that. And, of course, we're constantly frightening people, saying, oh, it's all being contained in this 50-gallon drums, and they're rusting through, and you know what's going to happen? And when it rusts through, it's going to burn all the way to China, or... you know, there's just no way to store it. There's nobody wants it in their backyard. Do you want it in your backyard? And, well, why don't we just reprocess it? They, of course, they never come up with a solution because they want the problem. And then, of course, what are you going to do with the depleted uranium? Well, you certainly don't want to be putting it onto warheads where it's going to really produce problems. We ought to just put it back in the uranium mines where it came from. That's where it came from. They can go back in there, and the uranium-238 can stay there for the next 4.5 billion years. Of course, I don't think the world's going to be around that length of time, but by then, of course, the depleted uranium, that's the half-life of the depleted uranium, at least half of it will have decomposed. Anyway, trouble is that we're not doing any of the logical things. What we should be doing, of course, is building another pipeline parallel to the pipeline that's already going through the Arctic tundra. You know, and of course, most of you probably imagine Alaska sort of like this beautiful playland for the reindeer. And I will tell you, I've been there. You get up north of Anchorage and you see a 6-foot tree, and it's a giant tree. I mean, there's nothing that's there. You know, even the moss doesn't grow very well. And of course, it's so cold and there's a permafrost, and you dig down 3 or 4 feet and you're into, you know, the permafrost in the frozen area there. And of course, the reindeer they love the pipeline because it's warm. It's the only source of warmth. The Eskimos up there want the development because, of course, they want jobs. And the only people who don't want this are the people who want to create a crisis here in America. Now, if you disagree with that, why, you can call in the next hour and talk to Lindsay Williams, who's going to be our guest. But right now, we're in the process of trying to get Joel Skousen, and we've given our telephone numbers to our producer, and so far hopefully Joel's going to be with us in just a few minutes, because Joel always has such a stimulating and a very, very thoughtful approach to so much of what's going on in the world today. You know, in fact, as we look at what's going on in Iraq, can you imagine that we would, of course, had this tremendous military ability to drive all the way to Baghdad and just a couple of weeks at the most. It wouldn't take them that long if it hadn't been for the sandstorms. And then when we get there and we take the city, we don't know what to do with it, and we can't get the electricity on, and we can't get the water running, and we can't stop the looting, and we allow them to loot, the museums and the historical places and destroy the heritage of the whole nation. I mean, how could you do anything that stupid unintentionally? And it wasn't that they didn't know that the museum and the other areas were going to be targets. They were told to guard them, and for some reason, they didn't. And then we have a gentleman named Shalabi, and Mr. Shalabi came from Iraq originally, unfortunately, he fled the country when Saddam came to power and went over into Jordan and cheated a lot of people out of their money there, and then, of course, fled off to, I believe, into England. And now we brought him back. We funded him. We've financing a small army, a couple of hundred people that he has. You know, he can have his own private army. We want to install him as the democratically elected leader, and the people over there just don't want him. So we really don't have any plan. It's terrible when you win a war and then you don't know what to do. And unfortunately, the only thing they're going to be able to do is take a lot of the ruthless people that Saddam Hussein had in power and put them back into power, if we ever hope to get things organized over there at all. Well, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to find Joel Skousen. I'm a little surprised. So we'll just take calls from our listening audience. If you're out there, you have a question or comment, our telephone number out across America is 1-888-24-LIBERTY, and here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And I don't know what happened to Joel, but I guess hopefully he'll come on later, or it'll just be you and me for the first hour. Or if we don't get him in about 2 minutes, I think I'm going to ask Jeannie to go ahead and get Lindsay Williams on the line, because we can talk to Lindsay for a couple of hours. In fact, I won't even get much of a word in edgewise. One of my favorite guests. Of course, they're both my favorite guests. So I'm going to ask Jeannie if we can't get Joel just to call Lindsay and ask him if he'll come on early, because he'll be a fascinating, fascinating guest. And, of course, I'm sure he'll be far more stimulating than my talking with absolutely nothing to talk about. I have nothing prepared other than discussing my latest newsletter, which deals with the program to create genocidal diseases, and you really don't want to hear about that. So, Jeannie, would you mind trying to get Lindsay on the line, and we'll just carry on a conversation with him. And, of course, we'll welcome your calls from out across America. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, another couple of interesting things that we actually did today. I pre-recorded a program, a weekend program with Dr. Dennis Cuddy. And, of course, Dennis is one of my favorite guests. And I always learned so much from him. He was pointing out that who do you think it is who is defending the Saudis from the lawsuit? You know, apparently the 600 families brought a suit against some of the Saudi princes for $1 trillion for their funding of Al-Qaeda, and of course for their funding the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center, and for continuing to fund Al-Qaeda after that. And of course the government, our government, has been covering for the Saudis. And we've refused absolutely to do anything about it. And so there was this lawsuit, and the government did everything they could to discourage it. It offered these people $1.5 million each that they just promised not to sue. And 600 families are going to go ahead and sue anyway. Now, they'd far rather get the truth out than, of course, get the sure $1 million, and they're not sure of getting anything if going as they are. And so who do you think has been assigned, or who do you think is protecting the Saudis, the defense attorney for the Saudis? He's a man named James Baker III. Who is James Baker III? Well, you remember, he was the Secretary of State in the first Bush administration. He was the lawyer who was actually appointed to go to Florida during the voting. This was when they were trying to determine who the president was going to be. And, of course, he was the one who defended George W. Bush and, of course, made sure that he got to be president. Mr. James Baker III is actually a major holder of Carlyle Corporation, this $14 billion holding company that bought up the Bradley fighting vehicle, the rights to build it many years ago, and, of course, bought up the mobile howitzer and other weapons production, because they knew that the war was coming. They bought these things up 6 or 8 years ago. And, of course, sitting on the board along with him is Frank Carlucci. Advisors are George Herbert Walker Bush and, of course, Henry Kissinger. And, of course, the major holders of Carlyle, along with James Baker III and Frank Carlucci, were the Carlyle family. Pardon me, I should say the Bin Laden family. And, of course, they were there. They were major holders until 9/11, and they sort of dropped out because that would have been just too obvious. People might have begun asking, gee, why is James Baker III and former President George Herbert Walker Bush so close to the Bin Laden family, and when Osama Bin Laden is our enemy, the man who, of course, planned the attack on the World Trade Center. And in fact, he was so evil, we went to war and killed all those people in Afghanistan because we had to capture Osama bin Laden. And then, of course, Osama bin Laden mysteriously disappears. And those of you who have heard this story, there was a Newsweek magazine. The Northern Alliance was closing in, about ready to capture him, and the Al-Qaeda with him. When in comes a fleet of black helicopters and whisk him away. Isn't that fascinating? Well, let's go to the line here. And who do we have? We have Joel Skousen on the line. Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
Well, my apologies, Stan. I had some car trouble overheating and was delayed in getting back to my phone. So with those apologies, I'm glad to be with you.
Well, I'm glad to have you. So very glad. Well, you know, because we always learn so much, and I know my listeners do as well. And so many of them comment they appreciate your views. So what are we going to discuss this evening? For our listeners out there, Joel publishes the World Affairs Brief. And, of course, it's a weekly email letter that brings you up to date on the things that are happening, and we'll tell you a little bit later how you can subscribe to this if you'd like to. But why don't you tell our listeners what the latest issues are that you think are important?
Well, I'd like to cover my midterm assessment of the Bush administration, and I've entitled it A Continuation of the Clinton Policies. George Bush, for example, you know, as you well know, and I know you've commented before, when he became president, not only did he fail to block implementation of the flood of executive orders signed in the waning minutes of the Clinton administration, but he directed Attorney General John Ashcroft to drop prosecution of all the pending investigations of Clinton's misconduct, including the egregious pardons that he issued for money for many criminal individuals. Of course, you know, Bush claimed that he was going to put all this behind us, and many conservatives took the president at his word. So it's only appropriate at midterm that we take a look at the Bush administration and see if this was an anomaly or whether or not he really is protecting Bush and
protecting Clinton.
I'm sorry, protecting Clinton. You know, it appears to me that Bush is actually taking guidance from the same CFR insiders that controlled, pampered, and protected his predecessor, who we often refer to as the most notorious criminal in chief. But in fact, you know, after the delivery of his second State of the Union message, it's now abundantly clear to me that George W. Bush not only intends to outspend Bill Clinton, increase the size of government, enact more socialist legislation, and make international intervention his hallmark, but he also intends to even maintain and defend all of the failed policies enacted by Clinton that conservatives hope would go away.
Well, one of the things that really disturbs me most is Bill Clinton's position that if we were to be attacked by Russia with a nuclear attack, we would not retaliate on when we knew the attack was coming. We would absorb the attack, and then if we had anything left, to respond with, we would respond, but if they knocked out all of our ground-based nuclear missiles and took out most of our submarines and planes, why, we wouldn't have anything to retaliate with. Why would anybody, certainly, let the enemy know that they could attack us and we might not ever be able to respond? That just doesn't make sense.
Well, of course, you're referring to Presidential Decision Directive 60, signed in November of 1997. This is still classified as secret, Stan, as you I'm sure are aware. And that means that even though we have a summary from the disarmament lobby which helped write this, you know, Bush doesn't write any of these executive orders or presidential decision directors. They're presented to him by the people who advise and control him, and he signs them and passes them on. But in specific, it says, basically, you're not to rely on Launch on Morning, which is the most powerful deterrent to a nuclear attack ever invented, specifically because it takes many minutes for missiles to arrive on site even after they've been launched. And in the interim period, with all of our satellite surveillance, we can detect which of their silos are empty and which of their bases are still vulnerable. We can retarget those. And when their missiles arrive, a good portion of our launch vehicles can be out of their silos, and thus the one who launches second in a launch on morning type of scenario usually creates the most damage. And so Clinton took this away, and Bush has refused to rescind PDD-60, which indicates to me that he is controlled by the same people that were, working Clinton.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen. We'll have a four-minute break for our listeners up in the Great Northwest. And, of course, the incredible thing about this is that we have replaced what used to be known as mutual assured destruction, which acts as a deterrent to an attack by Russia or Russia and China. with an agreed, just assured destruction of America. There would not be mutual at all because, of course, after the first attack, might not be able to respond at all. We'll be right back here in just a few minutes with Joel Skousen. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Joel Skousen. We're talking about PDD-60, which was put in by Bill Clinton. But, of course, this was the most egregious thing he could possibly have done. It was actually inviting a nuclear attack by the Soviet Union. And, of course, George Bush has left that stand, ensuring that if there were an attack, America would be largely, or at least our ability to retaliate would be largely destroyed, as would many of our major cities. Pick up the story from there, Joel.
Yes, you know, it really isn't mutually assured destruction. It's only the assured destruction of the United States. The United States has, except for its leaders, for which they have constructed approximately 20 new bunker systems. This is over and beyond the public ones, which the Russians and the American public know about, Mount Weather and the one at Camp David and others that have been decommissioned or turned over to civilian use or to FEMA use. There are a lot of new bunkers that have been built. Obviously, our American government knows that a nuclear strike is coming someday, but it's very, very strange that there has been no warning to the American people, no advice to prepare for nuclear attack and shelters. Despite all of the duct tape and plastic other little suggestions by FEMA, there has been nothing about a serious look at the potential of nuclear war. And this is especially real, even with the saber rattling that occurs with North Korea, who claims that they do have advanced missiles at least capable of reaching Hawaii or Alaska. So it isn't really mutually assured destruction because Russia, for example, has huge underground bunker systems, including the huge one at Yamato Mountain, and there's another one at Yazvinsky Mountain. These are both in the Urals, about 120 kilometers apart, and they are massive systems, about the each of them about the size of Washington, D.C. underground. So continuing on with, the Clinton policies that Bush has perpetuated, it's very interesting that as Bush, like Clinton, continues to pander to the environmental lobby, we find that he has not replaced or had removed any of the radical environmentalists which literally infest the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, and the National Park Service. These are the people that, as we speak, are in fact trying to implement the biodiversity treaty implications of buffer zones around all of the so-called national heritage sites. None of this has been voted upon by Congress. It is simply being mandated by edict. It was started during the Clinton administration, and it is in full force and continuation by the Bush administration. Even the poor Oregon farmers in the Willamette Valley.
Right.
They have not had their water rights restored, which were taken away supposedly to save some of the sucker fish stock in the area. So the Bush, continues to, give service to the environmental lobby, despite the fact that he has not implemented the Kyoto Treaty. He still has plans, and they are working to implement it slowly with some modifications. In other words, we're still not out of the woods. This president is not defending American productivity and industry from these radical environmental agendas, which are, based upon phony science. There is no global warming science that is legitimate. The same thing with the ozone layer. It varies up to 40% every 10 years, so it's virtually impossible to tell what effect Freon may have had.
Our special guest this evening is Joel Skousen, and we're just going to continue our discussion. Joel, go right ahead.
Yes. The Bush administration continues the Clinton policy of giving special preference to China, including the transfer of dual-use military technology to China. This is a very low-profile effort that is denied by the administration, but there are various sources within the Commerce Department that have leaked to more conservative publications that, in fact, there are special exemptions in the Commerce Department from the Department regulations banning export of military technology to China. And that's the only exemption there is. It's going to China. You know, the Bush has, like Clinton, refused to demand that the United Nations Human Rights Commission investigate China's widespread human rights abuses of torture, forced confessions, killings, religious suppression, arbitrary arrest. We made a big deal about Iraq and about the tyranny there. It's much worse, frankly, in China. It's much worse in North Korea. The Chinese prison system, called the Lao Gai, is larger than the Russian Gulag at its a high point in the Soviet era. So there clearly is a, you know, despite occasional warnings that come out of from the Pentagon about China, nevertheless, there is this backhanded policy of support for China, which is very disturbing. Continuing on, the Clinton brought open homosexuals into his administration, recommended them for Senate approval as government ambassadors or administrators. Bush has done the same thing, although without any publicity. He's obviously pandering to that lobby, but still trying to placate his conservative constituency. Nothing is more open about that than the fact that his hand-picked chairman of the Republican National Committee, his friend Mark Racicot from Montana, met with leaders of the Human Rights Campaign. This is a homosexual lobby at a luncheon in Washington. It was kept secret. But was first reported in the Washington Blade, which is an openly gay newspaper. And in response to a conservative firestorm of criticism which rose up over the meeting, a spokesperson for the RNC said that Racicot was honored to meet with gays. And Bush went even further than Clinton by actually giving millions of dollars to various homosexual lobbies that was hidden in the $15 billion funding for the AIDS campaign. This includes a host of pet research projects on the homosexual agenda, and it also emphasizes condom use rather than change of high-risk homosexual behavior. So there's a lots of hidden pork and pet projects in this $15 billion for AIDS.
Well, you know, one of the things that really disturbs me most is this whole process of globalization. Of course, it didn't start with Clinton. It really started with the first Bush administration. But I was just reading this evening before we came out here that there are 9.5 million Americans who are out of work, and another 4.5 million who have been out of work now. They're just back working half-time because they can't get a good job. We're talking over 13 million Americans who can't get a decent job now. And it's all a direct result of this effort of globalization because, of course, these jobs have left America. Our white-collar jobs are leaving. Our blue-collar jobs are leaving. Our major industries are being encouraged to move offshore. We reward the companies for keeping their money out of this country. They don't have to pay taxes on it if they invest it overseas. If they bring it back here, they've got to pay some 35% taxes, corporate tax. I wonder what they're going to do. We're doing everything to drive our industries offshore to redistribute the wealth of America, and the average American doesn't understand what's even happening.
Well, if I can, you know, respond to the economic implications of this, certainly it is true that there's a great deal of jobs that are going overseas, most particularly, I mean, not just in the manufacturing sector, to the Chinese goods that are being produced through Walmart and other companies that pretend to buy American. It's rather insulting to see all of this. You know, we're buying American when you can't hardly find anything in Walmart that was made in America. But nevertheless, there is an economic upside to that, of course. There's nothing that has driven the deflationary aspect of our economy, which has a great deal of benefit to the economy, as well as cheaper goods and prices. High tariffs, of course, may protect a few jobs, but in fact, the economy is spurred a lot more by lower prices. But there's another factor which I'll talk, I guess we have a break coming up.
Well, we've got about, go ahead. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Joel Skousen. His publication is World Affairs Brief. If you'd like to reach him, his website is www.joelskousen.com. That's www.joelskousen.com. I recommend his publication without hesitancy. I read it through whenever it comes, and I always look forward to his views. We'll be right here at Radio Liberty, wrapping up this portion in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and certainly our guest is Joel Skousen, and I'm going to ask Joel to tell our listeners how they can get copies of his publication. You have a telephone number as well as the website?
I do. For those that don't have access to the web and want a print edition sample of the World Affairs Brief, including this one that we're talking about tonight on the midterm assessment of the Bush administration, they can call my office at area code 801-224-4746, and I'll be happy to take your address and send you out some samples of the print edition of the World Affairs Brief.
That's 801-224-4746.
So that's correct.
Or go to joelskousen.com.
That's spelled JoelSkousen.
Okay.
As I was saying, Stan, about the economy, you know, one of the greatest reasons why the U.S. Wage and labor market cannot compete overseas is because of the high cost of government-mandated benefits and taxes on the labor portion of the employee ticket. For example, about 30% of a person's overall salary is not paid to the individual, but is paid to the government from workman's compensation. Social Security takes a big bite. If there's any one thing that President Bush could do to stimulate the economy rapidly, it would not be a tax cut. I mean, I'm always in favor of tax cuts. They do help, although that certainly isn't, you can't keep spending like they're doing and cutting taxes and not end up with a higher level of indebtedness. But if you really wanted to jumpstart the economy, there's one single thing that you could do more than anything else, and that is to completely strip away all requirements and regulations about labor relations. In other words, no, you don't have to pay any taxes. Each employee would pay for his own. There would be no workman's comp, you know, nothing. And of course, they would scream bloody murder that how are you going to take care of these poor people if they have an accident? But each person, you know, is much, much more capable of taking care of themselves if they were to get and be able to compete for higher wages that employers could pay if, in fact, they weren't obligated to pay almost 30% of wages you know, to the government. And there's also another factor. It is that millions of jobs could be created instantly if, in fact, there weren't these kinds of regulations in place. Think of how many domestic workers could be hired. Think of how many lower-paying people could be hired that simply cannot be employed at the present wage rate because you'd have to then file Social Security for them. You'd have to hire a bookkeeper to keep books on these people. We just need people to be able to say, I need somebody to work. And they say, well, this isn't a living wage. You know, how can you hire somebody at $3 and $4 an hour? The point is there's millions of jobs available at $3 and $4 an hour. People are available, that is, people who live with other people who don't, in fact, have to pay an entire rent or an entire mortgage on a home, that live with their parents, that live with friends, etc., are in a position to take these jobs, and it generates billions of dollars in income over and above what they're doing sitting at home making nothing or collecting welfare, and that money gets into the system. There's a multiplier effect that takes place, and those low paying jobs, actually, because millions of people are capable of immediately coming into that market, can jumpstart the economy and get things rolling.
Well, another thing is, of course, all the red tape and all the bureaucratic haggling to organize a plant. I see where, of course, China has a couple of areas where you can just go and start a plant and there's just no red tape at all. Come in, set up your plant, and you don't hassle with anybody. The people will stream in to work there, happy to work for, you know, a couple of dollars a day in China. And, of course, what a wonderful incentive that is for a company. If they had to set up a factory here in the United States, it would take them, you know, years and environmental impact studies and, you know, all sorts of land use permits and all sorts of permits, to the point where you sort of wonder, is it really all worthwhile?
Well, of course, many businessmen, I mean, even in my own business, which I'm retired from now, I could have hired numerous people in my security architectural business, but I chose not to. After having worked with employees for over 10 years and having so many headaches, you know, from dealing with the government bureaucracies, it's incredible how much time a business spends. If he makes even a small mistake on a form, the legal consequences can be terrible. The bureaucratic delays can be significant. I mean, even for 5 employees, I had to have one full-time person handling all of the accounting and the payroll just because it's so time-consuming. And so people like myself chose to use computers to do drafting, to do less work rather than hire employees. And I frankly have to admit that I don't miss having employees. I would have loved to have hired people, but I don't miss the headaches. And there are millions of people like myself who could hire people who don't, simply because of the red tape and the regulations involved in hiring people. Not to mention, of course, you know, the penalties and problems if you have all of these lawsuits for disabilities and discrimination and other things that can be charged with impunity, and there's very little defense against those.
Okay, fine. Well, of course, we're talking about, of course, the similarities between the Bush administration and the Clinton administration. And actually, when it comes to spending, why, Bill Clinton looks like a fiscal conservative compared with George W. Bush. But, of course, nobody's pointing that out. I mean, certainly they've increased the amount of money spending for overseas, for population control. There's a $15 billion AIDS package, another $10 billion for a federal control of education. I mean, the biggest power grab in education came not under Bill Clinton, but under our conservative president, George W. Bush.
You know, even internationally, George Bush is a worse interventionist than Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton, of course, promised to bring home the troops from Bosnia within a year. They're still in Bosnia. Even George Bush hasn't brought them home. And they are tied up, of course, in his deal that he made relative to the International Criminal Court, the treaty which Clinton, you know, signed enthusiastically, was never ratified. But nevertheless, Bush had a wonderful opportunity to withdraw from... of course, he didn't go into the treaty, but he signed kind of a devil's pact with the treaty. He agreed to stay in Bosnia if they would give them some kind of immunity against prosecution from the International Criminal Court. And in fact, he really didn't ask for immunity for everyone, just for political leaders and military, which doesn't make me sleep any better, of course, either. He also, of course, you know, talking about continuing the Clinton agenda, he has expressed an interest in supporting an extension of the semi-automatic assault rifle ban. He has stacked the deck on the commission generated by Secretary of Education Rod Page about a reassessment of Title IX, that thing that is, of course, with very tenuous interpretive language, has forced many colleges to abolish hundreds of wrestling teams and men's gymnastics and swimming because they couldn't afford to provide them for women on an equal basis. But what's interesting is that Bush pandered to the feminists, allowed them to have two or three people on this commission to review Title IX, and then Secretary Rod Page said that he wouldn't implement any changes unless they were unanimous recommendations of the commission. Now, in essence, what that does is give the feminist members a veto power over all the others. It's a very slick move that allows politicians to maintain a conservative front while stacking the deck in the details so that liberal policies continue to emerge. He's continued the don't ask, don't tell regulations rather than root out homosexuals out of the military. He has, of course, enforced the continued socialization of the military with co-ed service. It's raising havoc in the Navy. You know, having been a military officer myself, Stan, it's very, very problematic in military circles to have sexual tension within units. You know, there's enough difficulty with loneliness and other things and keeping people away from, you know, pornography and other, you know, gross problems. That's a real problem. But then you stick single women, it's no wonder, you know, that you have a huge pregnancy rate among the Navy, where you have these single people married and otherwise are getting pregnant at a high rate because of all of this sexual interaction that happens when you have 5,000 people on an aircraft carrier and you have 20 women. It's just not a good atmosphere. You know, Clinton administration abolished the Army's risk rule, which exempted women and support units from areas that might involve inherent risk of capture. That policy could have been changed with the stroke of a pen by Bush. He has not done so. So in the Gulf War, the Iraq War, we have a single mother of two very young children who was killed in the Iraq War, another single mother of a two-year-old who was taken as a POW. We have Army or Air Force flight surgeon who was had several broken ribs and broken arms in a helicopter crash, who was captured and fondled, even in her condition. You see, there really is no necessity to have these kinds of women put at risk. I would even be in favor of banning any women who have children from going on deployment at all. This is just improper for the United States military to be taking mothers away from their children on a permanent basis when they could serve stateside military and not be deployed. Now, to me, it doesn't make any difference if the women want to do this. This is irresponsible to be leaving one's children when you've got this kind of responsibility, and the taxpayers have no business paying for that kind of a policy. We still have basic training going on, co-ed basic training in the Army. The Marine Corps long ago did away with it because it was inefficient. The sexual tension between units, as well as the special substandard regulation or exceptions that were given for women, you know, that's a very problematic thing if you're mixing men with women. It isn't so much of a problem if you have all women units, because the men really don't know that they're not under the same criteria as they are. But when you intermix them, it's very obvious to everyone that these women can't keep up, that they're having to be given special attention. And people really worry about that in a combat situation, to have to deal with someone who can't carry the load in a combat situation. I know these things probably frustrate any feminist listeners that we have, but I have to speak directly. I can see no benefit in the military. I don't care how much women may want to be treated as equal. They are simply not equal in terms of physical strength in most cases. And there are many other problems, of course, with privacy in the field and other things that are difficult, not to mention, of course, the constant problem of sexual tension, which is deleterious to the morale of a unit.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and of course, the God made men and women different, and he didn't make women to go to war.
A couple of other things, you know, Bill Clinton was very notorious for his secrecy, for covering up for his own wrongdoing, for government wrongdoing. Bush has been just as bad, to cite a few examples. Vice President Cheney's stonewalling of the congressional subpoena for information on the secret energy meetings he held with Enron and others. President Bush invoked executive privilege to keep Congress from investigating FBI dealings with the mafia in Boston. He invoked executive privilege and has used national security classifications to keep certain information about the administration foreknowledge of 9/11 attacks to keep them from Congress and the 9/11 Commission. Like Clinton, Bush administration is engaged, I have to frankly say, in systematic lying to the public. Examples of this are legion. I've detailed many instances in my prior World Affairs briefs, such as the falsification of intelligence information to justify the war in Iraq. There are denials of insider dealings between members of the Bush administration, its various oversight agencies, with corrupt corporations like Enron, WorldCom, Global Crossing. And yet these continue to crop up. It's almost brazen how Enron is coming back with special deals that the government's giving. WorldCom just got a cell telephone contract in Iraq, even though they have hardly any cell service at all. That's their subsidiary, MCI. This is a bit player compared to the big cell phone company, yet they got the contract. You know, the funny thing about bidding on these Iraqi contracts is that these bids were let before the war had actually begun. There had been no inspections. I mean, how do you bid as Brown & Root, subsidiary of Halliburton, on the repair of the oil wells when they haven't even been attacked yet, when you haven't ever inspected them? How do you give a fixed bid millions of dollars, you know, on that basis. You know that this is insider dealing, because no one in the right mind would give a bid on something that they've never seen.
So, and I really think that really is very, very disturbing, especially when Dick Cheney is still getting a salary from Halliburton. Now, of course, they said it's a deferred salary. I don't know what that means, but he's getting $160,000 a year from Halliburton, and then, of course, Halliburton gets this multi-$600 million contract, something like that. I would think that somebody might suggest that maybe it was just a payment for services. Let's go to Ron, who's calling us from Richland, Washington. Hi, Ron. A question or comment?
I just have some, well, first a comment. I really enjoy listening to Joel Skousen. I have shared his website with a number of people who work in the intelligence field. I thought that his information would be very
Stan,
very important.
I'm not hearing a single thing he says.
All right. In fact,
to me.
All right. Basically, he says how much he enjoys your website, and he has actually shared the information on it with people he knows who work in intelligence. And we'll have to try to get our engineer to get this straightened out, because we're having real problems with this line. Anything else, Ron?
Well, I was just wondering. I had his opinion on the effectiveness of certain organizations, such as Judicial Watch.
All right, fine. Any other questions?
Yeah, and WorldNet Daily.
All right, fine. Well, let's ask him. Ron wants to know your opinion of the effectiveness of organizations like Judicial Watch and WorldNet Daily.
Well, I was an early supporter, and I still support in principle Larry Klayman's work with Judicial Watch, but I've been very disappointed that despite all of the fundraising letters it sends out talking about all of the cases to be filed, it really hasn't won hardly anything at all, which is to be expected, because I'm very skeptical about the judicial system. Even the one judge who's very, very favorable, appears favorable to Larry Klayman in Washington, D.C., district, through which he goes through for most of his courses, you know, keeps chastising the Clinton administration, keeps chastising the Bush administration, but he never does come down and actually put any of those people in jail or call them on contempt of court. And so we continue to have all of these court cases, but I don't see them being won. The judicial system is very, very corrupt. WorldNet Daily has a very big effect generally, especially because they have not become like Newsmax.com, which has just become a shill for the Bush administration. The same thing with the Washington Times. Washington Times was very, very effective during the Clinton administration, but is simply a cheerleader for the Bush administration. Inside Magazine is a little bit different, even though it's the same company. They do have some very strong reporters and do some real in-depth work, but I will give Joe Farah probably a real B+ for what he does, because he does tackle the hard issues sometimes, and he will even mention the word conspiracy. He's he gets his feathers ruffled easily. Anytime I've criticized him, he's come unglued, even though I'm on his same side. But generally speaking, I think he does pretty effective
job. All right, Ron, does that answer your question?
Well, that starts to. I was reading a book, Our Nation Betrayed, by Garland Favorito, and wondered his opinion of that gentleman in his book.
Garland Favorito, A Nation Betrayed. Do you know anything at all about it?
Yes, very, very good book. Highly recommend it.
All right, fine. Ron, anything else?
One other thing about, I think it was Don Henry and Kevin Ives and their murder in Arkansas, if someone's ever pursuing that.
Well, this is the boys on the railway tracks.
Right.
I think that thing's pretty well gone by the wayside. The FBI covered for the murderers. And, of course, anybody who's ever tried to really get to the bottom of that has run into real, real, real problems. So, hey, Luck, thanks so much for your call, Ron.
Yes, sir.
Bye-bye. Okay, fine. That was Ron from Richland, Washington. And, of course, he had a lot of questions. But let's get back to our subject, was comparing the Bush administration with its predecessor, the Clinton administration. Were there any other points you wanted to make there, Joel?
Well, those are the the major points. It's really interesting, as I criticize the Bush administration a great deal, I've gotten a lot of flack from my fellow conservatives. Some of them have written to me and said, gee, you just sound like just like the socialists, in your criticism of Bush. And I have to reply back, you know, if you want to look at who's a socialist, look at President Bush himself. I've challenged him. You name me one piece of legislation that he's proposed that isn't socialist in nature. It's very, very embarrassing. I want to bring up another thing about what's happening in Iraq under the Bush administration, because one of the things that has continued under Clinton, we talked about PDP 60, and I have spoken to military generals in the Marine Corps who I'm familiar with, asked them how did they react to PDP 60, and they said, we were just horrified. I said, I didn't hear anything from you, there was no press, and they said, well, obviously, you know, we're not allowed to say anything publicly against the commander-in-chief. And I said, well, I should hope that you would. How is the public going to know that of this suicidal directory? You know, even though these are good men, they've become virtual yes men. And, you know, that's something about, we believe in civilian control of the military. The civilian control doesn't mean that the military can't take their case to the public, cannot lobby the public. I realize they have this very egregious law that says you can't say anything derogatory about the commander-in-chief, and that's been interpreted very liberally by the military to prosecute any officer who writes a letter to the editor critical of, as this Air Force colonel was at the Monterey Institute of Languages, was dismissed for having criticized Bush and intimated that he may have had some responsibility in 9/11. But I really think our military officers need to stand up and lobby the public, as General MacArthur did, and try to get the public to put pressure on our politicians so that they will not steer the military in the correct way.
Well, of course, Joel, that would be the end of your military career. Now, when you're a five-star general, you can speak out. The worst they can do is fire you. But if you are a military officer, like the lieutenant colonel who was the dean over here at the Monterey language school and spoke out, that ended his military career.
That's right, and the same thing happened just this last week in Iraq. In a two-hour meeting, the head of Army Public Affairs in Mosul, Major Charmaine Means, a woman major, refused to authorize troops seizing a radio station which the U.S. government wanted shut down because they were giving too much pro-Arab propaganda. She argued that the presence of armed soldiers would intimidate the station's Arab employees and would, of course, make the U.S. look very, very bad around the world. She was told, after she refused to do this numerous times, to pick up a nearby telephone. On the other end was her chief of staff of the division, saying that she was ordered to do as General Petros had planned about shutting down the station. She refused once again and was relieved of her duties on the spot and shipped out of Mosul on the next helicopter the next morning. Now, such stories like this spread like wildfire among officers in the military. And the message is clear. You buck the system and you get canned. So it's a sad truth that people of consistent principles don't last long in the military.
That, of course, is what's so sad about it. And that's why you and I have to say the things that they can't, and why I appreciate so much your willingness to take a stand in times like these, where dossiers are being kept on every American citizen, and, of course, through the Total Information Awareness System. They've changed the name, but not, of course, the objective and goal, which was, of course, laid out so descriptively in the logo that they had on the Total Information Awareness website,
the
pyramid
kept
by an all-seeing eye overlooking the world.
You know, it's amazing how much power the U.S. has, though. I'm amazed as they manipulate the U.N. The getting a vote of 14-0 on the Security Council to back almost total U.S. control of the reconstruction of Iraq was nothing short of egregious backroom dealing. I mean, for Germany, France, and Russia to capitulate when they had the veto power to stop the U.S. from getting this approval was just nothing short of amazing. I can't help but believe that they had to have promised them a great big cut of the oil revenues if they went along with this. I mean, all three countries, Germany, France, and Russia, had dealings with Iraq prior to the war, during the war, especially Russia, who given about $8 billion in military aid to Iraq, and I think, clearly the U.S. has probably decided to give them some underhanded payments of at least $5 to $6 billion. Even as they know that Russia, for example, has begun giving military aid to the Taliban in Afghanistan to try to undermine the Karzai regime, the U.S. continues to cover for this kind of Soviet-styled intransigence.
Well, we're in real trouble, and of course, behind everything going on today are these spiritual forces that I write about in the Brotherhood of Darkness. We're out of time, Joel. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners?
Well, I think it's very interesting when Ari Fleischer, President Spokesman, resigns, and the spokesman of Prime Minister Tony Blair resigns. Obviously, they know they're covering for their leaders and a lot of lying going on, and I think they know it's deleterious to their reputation long-term to stay on. So they know something that the rest of the public should know.
Amen. And of course, General Franks is resigning, and there are quite a few key people. I think General Tommy Franks did not want, he's only 57, and offered the position of head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And obviously, he's not about to compromise his position to be a yes man to people he disagrees with. So I want to thank you so very much for being with us. We'll look forward to having you again here on Radio Liberty in the near future.
And thank you, Stan. I always enjoy it.
Good night. All right, well, that was Joel Skousen, and I hope you enjoyed the program. And, of course, this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is listener-supported. And if you agree that there's a problem, if you'd like to become part of our team, our number, 1-888, our number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And I hope many of you will seriously consider joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And, of course, that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours every day. And if you'd like a free copy of our newsletter, of course, it's available by calling that same number, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we also mentioned we have a great video. It's called The War in Iraq, or Iraq, The Untold Story. Iraq, The Untold Story. We have a syllabus that goes with that. We have a great syllabus, Sustainable Development, and a video that goes with that. And if you haven't read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or the book of Regicide, which goes into the assassination of President Kennedy and why the CIA had him killed, and who did it, why. All of this is available. If you'd like to know more, go to our website at radioliberty.com, or, of course, check our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, we ask our listeners to pray for America, because at one time this was a great and noble Christian nation. Unfortunately, it's been taken over by a small group of people who are in the Project for the New American Century, and their friends in the Council on Foreign Relations, which is a front organization for a secret English society that was formed in 1891 by Cecil Rhodes. And this is all covered in my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to have that information. You need to help us get that information out. And then we ask you to pray for our ministers, because this truly is a spiritual battle. What energizes all of the secret societies are satanic and Luciferian forces. And if you read their writings, the writings of Manly P. Hall, the writings of Madame Blavatsky, the writings of Albert Pike, the most revered of Masons, his book Morals and Dogma, you'll find it's all Luciferian. In fact, they've even taken the name Lucifer out of all of the Bibles except the King James Bible. They simply rewrote all the Bibles and remove Lucifer's name. Why do you think they did that? Well, ladies and gentlemen, please remember to pray for our Ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. And so until next Monday, when we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, and the views of our callers. We welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Mr. Lindsey Williams. And I asked Lindsey to come on with us because the program we did last night with our good friend Michael Rupert, and I like Michael, he's done a lot of great work, certainly on the CIA and drugs, and really on many, many important issues. But last night he was talking about this conference he'd been to over in Paris. He'd just gotten back from it. It was called the Peak Oil Conference. And the basic theme, of course, this was put on by CFR people, by these establishments, sustainable development, head in the clouds people, who are putting out the theory or the theme of the Club of Rome, that they put out in 1971 in their book, Limits of Growth, in which they said, the world is running out of natural resources, and we're just going to have to either do away with most of the population or lower our living standards. It's doom and gloom, and it's even worse than that, but we don't want to tell you how bad it is. And that was sort of the basic theme, you know. We're used up over half of the oil that's in the world, and there really isn't any natural gas up there, on the, certainly on the North Slope, and there's very little oil up there, enough to run America maybe for 45 days if it was developed. And really, we found all the oil that there is in the world, and the price of natural gas is going to go up because there's going to be shortages here in the United States. And we really can't, well, we can develop nuclear energy, but of course that won't solve many of our problems, because nuclear energy is the most expensive type of energy. And if we want to burn coal, well, it's going to take energy to, and we want to convert coal into oil and gasoline. We've got large coal supplies, but that would take so much energy, and it would take more energy to convert the coal into oil and gasoline than it would, so we'd actually be losing energy by doing that. And, you know, you get all done and you just think, gee, the world is hopeless, and maybe all we can really do is just cut back our living standards. Maybe we had a little tent someplace, and maybe just a little campfire once in a while. Why we'd have to live that way with all the Chinese coming online and the Malaysians and all the cars in the world, and we're going to run out of oil. We've already on the downhill slide. Most of the oil has already been used up. We've peaked out. Well, Lindsey Williams has a little different take on that, so I wanted you to hear what Lindsey had to say. Hi, Lindsey, how are you doing?
Dr. Stan, thank you so very much for allowing me to be on your show tonight.
Well, it's always a pleasure, and I appreciate you coming on such short notice. But I just, you know, the Lord works in certain ways, and he kept this hour open, you know, and I called half a dozen people, and none of them, you know, in the last week, and none of them could come on. I said, well, I'll just come on and talk, you know, for the full hour myself, you know, and maybe people will call in. And then I got to thinking, you know, we need to counter what we heard last night, because I think Michael Rupert is very honest, and I think he's very straightforward, and I think he really believes what he says. But I don't believe that he was getting the straight scoop. I think that those people over in Paris are trying to push this whole idea of sustainable development, and the ideas of Marie Strong and Mikhail Gorbachev and Stephen Rockefeller, and this whole bunch of people who just want to lower the living standards for everybody but the elite. So why don't you pick up and tell your story right now, and don't worry, a lot of the people out there haven't heard it. Do say whatever you want to, and don't be afraid of being repetitive.
Well, I agree with you 100%. This program definitely is by the providence of God tonight. I was here, more than happy to be on your show on a few moments' notice. And I agree likewise with Michael Rupert, who was on your program last night. I think these men, in honesty, say what they say, just as Senator Hugh Chance, in honesty, believed what he believed when he came to the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline and visited with me in 1974. Let me go back just a little ways for the sake of those who are listening to the program for the first time tonight and bring you up to date as to why I can say what I say and with what authority Senator Hugh Chance had when he came to the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. In 1970, I was a missionary in the state of Alaska. It was that year that they announced that they were going to build that 800-mile pipeline across the state of Alaska called the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. It began at the big oil field at Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, and it was going to wind up in Valdez, and it would take about 3 years to construct it and approximately $12 billion. They said also that 25,000 pipeliners were going to converge on the state of Alaska to build that pipeline. Naturally, being a missionary, the first thing that came to my mind was 25,000 pipeliners, and I had known them to be back when I was in Texas a few times, to be some of the most wicked cuss and just drinking just folks on the face of the earth, and I thought to myself, those men must need some spiritual guidance. So I went to Alyeska Pipeline Service Company. I remember Mr. R.H. King was a personnel relations man, and I said, I'd like to be a chaplain on the pipeline. Well, they laughed at me. They said, we never had a chaplain on any pipeline in the world. What are we going to do with you? Well, I kept going back and back and back. I was persistent. I had a job to do, and I knew the Lord wanted me there. Well, finally, one day, they said, okay, we'll give you those northern seven camps from Prudhoe Bay, where the big oil field is, to Galbraith Lake. And they said, you just do anything you can. Whole worship service, help the men, counsel, do anything you like. But we can't pay you anything. I'm quite sure they thought I'd go home if they didn't pay me. My denomination paid me, so why should I accept money from them? So I said, okay. Well, they allowed me in the camps. I remember my first trip up there in June of 1973. And about 6 months later, Mr. King, R.H. King, personnel relations man, came to me and said, Lindsay, we are amazed. You are helping the relationship between management and labor so much and doing so much counseling free of charge with those men. We'd like to give you executive status, and we've just voted that in our meeting the other day down in Anchorage. And I said, well, what does that mean? He said, well, you can go any place you'd like, see anything you want to see. We'll give you a vehicle, let you travel as you will, write you on airline tickets when you go back and forth home about every 4 or 5 weeks. And I said, well, I appreciate that very much. I did not have the slightest idea, Stan, what I was going to see for the next 3 years, because they said, we'd like to invite you to sit in on our board meetings in an advisory capacity in order to help the relationship between management and labor. What I heard and saw over the next 3 years, when I sat with some of the most power-controlling, manipulative. Now, this is by the providence of God. I did not look for this. I did not snoop. I never one time went any place that I was told not to go. And I rubbed shoulders with the biggest oil men in the world, some of the biggest bankers in the world, sat across the table from some of the executives with the oil companies day after day. And what I heard for the next 3 years changed my life. If someone had asked me in 1971, do you believe that there's a group of men on the face of the earth who control the world, I would have said, who are you, a John Bircher? And I would have laughed at them. If someone had asked me in 1978, do you believe that there's a group of people on the face of the earth that manipulate nations, control currencies, and control the news media even, I would have said, not only do I believe it, I sat and listened to them talk about it. I remember one night I went back to my dorm room. I was so amazed at what I had heard that day in one of the business meetings. I lay down on my bed. I looked up at the ceiling, and I said, God, I have trouble believing that there's such a group of people on the face of the earth as those that I've just heard, who are intentionally planning what they're going to do 8 to 10 and 12 years from now, and what is going to come out in the news media and what they're going to tell the world. Well, in 1974, I believe it was, Senator Hugh Chance, he was a personal friend of mine from the state of Colorado. He was state senator in the state of Colorado. And I asked him to come to the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. It's been 1 week with me. I'd gotten permission from the oil companies for him to come up there. And he was a Christian and was going to speak in my worship services for 1 week and travel the pipeline with me to the seven camps. I remember he arrived. I made arrangements for him to meet Mr. Ken Fromm, who was a senior executive with Atlantic Richfield. I made arrangements for him to meet Mr. Jim Lawler, who was one of the top men with Atlantic Richfield and over to BP side of the oil field. And all week long, he talked with these men, one right after the other, went to all the camps. And I remember just before he left, I'll never forget what he said. In fact, he wrote it as the foreword in my book, The Energy Non-Crisis. It's actually recorded here for those who happen to get my book. Senator Hugh Chance said, just before he left, he said, "Lindsey, I can hardly believe what I've seen and heard this week." And I said, "Hugh, what do you mean?" He said, "Only a few weeks ago, I was sitting in the Senate of the state of Colorado when we state senators were briefed as to the severity of the energy crisis." He said, "From what I have seen and heard here today, I have come to realize that almost everything that I was told in that briefing sitting in the Senate of the state of Colorado was an outright misrepresentation of the truth and was a lie, and we were briefed intentionally falsely in order for us to believe what they wanted us to believe."
Sounds just like that big conference they just put on over in Paris. Peak oil meeting.
That's the reason that I can't be critical of Michael Roper. He heard what he heard. But he was intentionally misbriefed because there is probably as much crude oil on the, and the reason I use the word probably is because they won't even let them go into the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and drill. There is probably as much crude oil on the North Slope of Alaska as there is in all of Saudi Arabia put together. There is enough natural gas up there to supply the entire United States of America for over 200 years, known reserves now. If every other natural gas well in America were cut off tomorrow morning at the projected rate of increased consumption.
And, of course, they are doing everything they can to block another pipeline coming down there, just following along the pipe that's already there, which could carry the natural gas to the 48 states.
So, that is correct.
And so are they going to allow them to put in that pipeline or for the natural gas, you know?
When they built the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline Corridor, they built it to accommodate three pipelines, two crude oil and one natural gas. The oil companies had been suggested to them that they would be able to build those three pipelines. When they finished the corridor, now mind you, you can't hurt the ecology any more than what has already been harmed, and it was not harmed, believe me. I'm an Alaskan. I love the out-of-doors. I love the animals, and I don't want the ecology hurt. When they built the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline, the building of that corridor, you can't hurt it any worse than what little bit it has already been done, and to accommodate two more pipelines would not have in any way whatsoever have affected the ecology. And when they finished the one crude oil pipeline, the government said, "Stop. No more. You will not build a natural gas pipeline. You will not build another crude oil pipeline." And until this day, they will not allow them to build either.
Well, now, I understand that the reindeer really sort of like those pipelines because it's something sort of warm there when it gets so cold. Is that true?
Oh, positively. In fact, grass grows greener in the area where the corridor is because it's been cleared and seeded and so on. And the caribou... all the animals just love it there.
Now, I understand that the indigenous people, the Eskimos, they're all in favor of this as well.
Well, positively, they won't, because naturally they make royalties off of everything that comes out of the ground, and they would love for those other two pipelines to be built, and I would too, because I well remember back in 1965, I had a little Mercedes diesel back in those days, and I could fill up my gas tank, my diesel, for 25 cents a gallon. Look at it today. We're up to $2 a gallon and becoming accustomed to it. It doesn't make sense.
Well, now, of course, one of the things you mentioned when you were on with this before was that they were actually at these big 747 engines, and they were simply pumping the natural gas back into the ground. They couldn't release in the atmosphere, and there's so much natural gas that's coming up with the oil, and so they have to just pump it back down in the ground. Is that true?
What you're referring to is an atrocity of atrocities. And if the average American could go to Fruto Bay as I did, now I lived there for 3 years. I'm not talking off the top of my hat. I am not talking as a person who did not see physically, literally myself, and I am still in touch with some of the top executives who were there at the time. And the natural gas that is at Fruto Bay, the oil companies begged to produce a natural gas pipeline, liquefy that natural gas in Valdez, take it out by tanker to the West Coast, or to even build a pipeline across Canada. They offered to do both from the end of the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Today, because they would not allow any of that natural gas to be taken out of Prudhoe Bay, Alaska. Now, this was the fact given me by Mr. Jim Lawler just a matter of a few weeks ago. Every 24 hours at Prudhoe Bay, Alaska, there are 48, those in the listening audience may wish to write this down, there are 48 747 type jet engines. Now, you may have noticed a picture of a 747 jet aircraft engine. A person can actually stand up in the intake of that engine and not even touch the top if they were a six-footer. They are huge. There are 48 of those that have been designed to pump natural gas, which they will not let them burn off, by the way. I understand that Mr. Michael Rooper was told that they're burning off a little bit of that gas at Prudhoe, but they won't let them burn one single cubic foot of it. They've never allowed it from the beginning. It must be pumped back into the ground, according to order from the government of the United States of America, and every 24 hours today, right now, at Prudhoe Bay, there are 38 747-type jet aircraft engines working around the clock 24 hours a day to pump that natural gas back into the ground, and they are pumping at the rate of 1 billion. Now, that is correct. I did not say million. 1 billion cubic feet of natural gas are pumped back into the ground every day that comes up with the oil.
1 billion cubic feet of natural gas. That would certainly run an awful lot of homes and a lot of generators, natural gas generators here in the States. Are you incidentally on a hardline telephone? Occasionally your voice is sort of fading away.
No, I'm just on a regular telephone.
All right, fine. Well, then we'll just keep going as we are because it's coming through pretty well. And so this is an amazing story. Now, how much natural gas is up there? And I do know anything at all about the Wrangel Islands. You know, we gave those to the Russians, and I heard that there was tremendous amount of oil all through the Aleutian Islands. Is that true? Do you know anything about that?
I do understand that there was a tremendous amount of oil and natural gas that was connected with those islands and also on the Aleutian Islands. I cannot verify that as I was not there, and
all
I
right.
do not know those who have drilled there.
But anyway, there's tremendous. You say there's as much oil up there in the on the North Slope as there is in all of Saudi Arabia, or at least it's believed there is, and everything is being done to block its development. Now, why would the people in Washington, D.C. be so intent upon making us dependent upon foreign oil?
Well, that would be a calculated guess for me to say why. I have my ideas. Some of the oil men that I have talked with have their ideas as to why it's being done. I really don't know except that, well, then again, it would be supposition. I know what's there. I know what I saw. I know what Senator Hugh Chant saw. I was so concerned about all of this that after the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline was over, and I was never told not to print it, I decided that I must tell names, dates, places, and put it all into a book. It became a bestseller in a matter of a few months because people were begging for the truth about natural gas and crude oil. So to see why they want us to be dependent on these other countries, it would be a calculated guess. If you want me to give my own personal opinion, I'll be glad to.
Go ahead. And this is a calculated guess. This is not anything that we're going to send out with an official seal. But I just was curious as to why Lindsay thought that they certainly are suppressing the development of that natural oil there.
After the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline was over and I wrote my book, The Energy Non-Crisis, 3, 4, 5 years later, I wrote another book entitled Syndrome of Control. I remember George Hansen and I were out there on the trail speaking together one day in Texas, And you and I both were familiar with George back in those days when he was at his peak of glory. And he said to me, Lindsay, if you're crazy enough to print it, I'll be glad to give you some information. But he said, I wouldn't put it in the book for anything in this world. But he said, you and the author, if you want to do it, you can. And I dared to write a book entitled Syndrome of Control, in which I mentioned why I felt that these people were doing what they were doing. And I do not think it's for money. I do not necessarily believe that it's for fame, because they don't want that. In fact, they don't even want to be known sometimes. I think it's totally for the purpose of power, control, and manipulation of humanity. That's all I could figure out when I met people on the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline that I met, was that they were doing what they were doing for the purpose of power and control.
And I think that's probably right. And I think that maybe these are energized by perhaps spiritual forces, whether the people know it or not. There really is evil in the world. And sometimes this can, of course, seize the hearts and desires of men, even though they may not understand why they do bad things. They do them intentionally.
Yes, I agree with you 100%. And naturally, both of us being believers and Christians, we look at it from that perspective. Let me give you one story that will probably verify this. I had finished up the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline work. I had even written my book, The Energy Non-Crisis, and one day I had a phone call from Mr. Ken Fromm. He and I had become very close friends because he likewise was a believer. And he stayed in touch with me for quite a while after the pipeline, and one day he called me at my home in Alaska, and he said, Lindsay, are you going on speaking tour anytime soon? And I said, well, it just so happens I'm leaving next week, starting out in Washington State. We'll be lecturing all the way to the end of Southern California over the next 3 months. He said, well, let me give you a little tip that might be interesting to you. At that point, crude oil was $35 a barrel, if I remember correctly. And he said, let me tell your audiences that crude oil is going to go between $10 and $12 a barrel. It's going to plummet overnight. I said, Ken, come on. I said, you know, there's no way in the world that that can happen. I said, that would cramp the style of the Arab world. They can't keep up their economy that way. And he said, well, but Lindsay, just tell your audiences that. I said, well, Ken, how do you know that? He kind of chuckled and he said, Lindsay, you know good and well that all this is planned. He said, I know it in advance. And I said, yeah. He said, I guarantee it's going to happen. Well, I did. I said that to my audiences, and I literally was laughed at on the platform. When it actually went to $12 a barrel, my phone almost rang off the hook, and they said, you're a prophet. And I said, no, I'm not a prophet. I got it from the person who is one of the ones that helped to plan it all. And I said, they knew it in advance. Well, they had done it for a reason. Back in the days when oil went to $35 a barrel, they told the Arab world, buy gold, buy gold, buy gold. You may remember that that was the last time that gold prices were inflated all the way up to, oh, what was it, $700,
$800? Yeah, they just
price. Oh, and they told them to buy it by the carload. Oh, you need to get all the gold you can. Buy it while you can. They had a plan. The whole time they had a plan, and I knew about it. Ken, let me know without any doubt. Well, when the price of oil went to $12 a barrel, in order to keep their economy going, it's kind of a socialistic thing. The sheikhs and sheikhs do everything they can to keep the people in line, give them everything imaginable. And they said, we have to sell our gold now. We can't keep our economy going like it is. By that time, they had brought gold back down to $400 an ounce, and they had to sell it back to the very same people that they had bought it from for $800 an ounce. They had to sell it back to them for $400 an ounce in order to be able to keep their economy going and the people in line. And every single bit of it had been done by a design plan years in advance.
Well, you know, that's so interesting. I heard a very similar plan from a very, very much of an insider, and I can't give his name at all, talking about what the future holds in the Middle East. And he was talking about, of course, it was after we had won the war with Iraq, talking about how first we'll, of course, put pressure on Syria and Lebanon, and they'll either fold or we'll take them. But then, of course, we'll destabilize Iran. because, of course, half the population there is less than 25 years of age, and they don't like the Islamic government. And, of course, half the population is women, and they hate the Islamic government. And so there's really not very many people over there. Even most of the men don't like the Islamic government. So it wouldn't be very hard to topple that. And this is, of course, what we're going to do. And although it wasn't said, I suspect they're just going to pay off some of the army generals, and like we did in Iraq, and that'll be the end of Iran. But then, of course, we can take the Iraqi oil and the Iranian oil, and we can dump it on the world market and drive the price down and destabilize Saudi Arabia. And that'll be the end of Saudi Arabia, or whatever we'll do there, of course, will replace, to some extent, the ruling situation, or alter the ruling situation. Some people have suggested they'll divide Iraq into the oil-producing area and the area over by Mecca, and let the Wahhabis have the area around Mecca and Medina, and, of course, we'll have the oil, or at least we'll be able to control the oil. But we'll bring that price of oil down, which will be great for our economy. But, of course, it will also destroy the economy there of Saudi Arabia. And, you know, as I heard that, I thought, you know, this is truly Machiavellian. But I wouldn't be at all surprised if this isn't what they really intend to do.
Yes. Let me make a statement that many in the audience, you think about it for a while. The increase of a price of a gallon of gas at the gas pump is a form of worldwide taxation. Now, that may seem startling at first, but if I had not been on the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline, I could not have made that statement if I did not listen to those who talk as they do. Let me briefly explain. The Arabs used to think, at one time they thought that they controlled the price of a barrel of oil. And OPEC, they thought they did. They found out they don't. They have nothing to do with it. The price of a barrel of oil is controlled by those who sit behind the computers in New York and London every day and tell the Arabs what they're going to give them for it. Every time that the price of a gallon of gasoline goes up to the gas pump, it is a form of taxation, because the money does not wind up in the pockets of the Arabs necessarily. A little pittance of it does. But the massive amount of it goes right into the hand, winds up eventually in the hands of the power controllers of the world and the World Bank. Therefore, every time they need money, all they do is find a way of increasing the price of a gallon of gas at the gas pump. It finally winds up into the pockets of the World Bank. And likewise, they are taxing the world without you knowing that they're actually charging you taxes. I watch it, or I've watched over the years, every time that they needed money. Now, right now, the price, right now, the interest rate is so low in America until the Federal Reserve is having a problem. And as a result, they've got to find money somewhere else. So where do they find it? They find it by increasing the price of the gallon of gas at the gas pump, and they still get the same amount of money. They just get it from another place, another source, but yet they can still loan it out and do what they've done in many countries of the world, third world countries, by actually confiscating the countries by giving them loans, which are nothing but a computer entry. So every time you pay a penny more at the gas pump, you're actually paying a cent more in the form of a method of taxation that has been developed by them for the purpose of putting the money in their pockets.
That's a fascinating, fascinating concept, and I think that most people find it difficult to believe that anything could be quite that diabolical. But the other thing was, and I remember reading in Foreign Affairs magazine, which is, of course, published by our invisible government, and they talked about, well, so the Arabs have all this money. What are they going to do with it? Why, they're going to have to put it in our banks. You know, and of course, once it's in our banks, of course, then we control it. But, you know, it doesn't do, they're not going to bury it in the ground. They have to do something with that, either buy something with it or put it in our banks, because they're the only banks that are safe. And that's exactly what they did. And then, of course, we had the use of that money. And then, of course, the poor old Iranian, the Shah of Iran, put a lot of his money in our banks. And then, of course, after Iran fell, and then, of course, we had the hostage crisis, then we froze all the Iranian money here, and we had its use for quite some time after that. So we'll be right back here in just a moment with Lindsay Williams, and, of course, welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY for Lindsay Williams. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this afternoon is Lindsay Williams. Lindsay, before we forget, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get the various books? You've actually written 4 books, and you have a video on the vaccination. So why don't you tell them about that?
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. I'd very much like to. I feel so compelled because of what's happening in the Middle East and because of what's taking place in our world right now to get the information out. I will do almost anything. So I'd like you to know the entire story exactly as I lived it. So I want to give you, that's correct, I'd like to give you as a gift all four of the books that I've written. I've written 6 books total, but I'd like to give you 4 of them. The one entitled The Energy Non-Crisis. It is a full-length, over 200 pages, paperback book. My second book, To Seduce a Nation, which likewise is not a pamphlet. It is a full-length, over 200-page book, paperback. My third book entitled Syndrome of Control, which is, to me, the most startling of all of my books because it's my opinion as to what I saw on the pipeline out of the world controllers. And then my latest book entitled You Can Live, which is on alternative health. And sometimes, by the way, Dr. Stan, we might want to do a program on SARS. This is becoming a major issue in health fields right now. So if you'd like to have all 4 of these books, I've also produced numerous videos, one entitled The Energy Non-Crisis, another one which is a must right now, and that is vaccinations. Oh, please, learn the story about what our soldiers have gone through over there in the Middle East and the vaccination issue what your children are being given with DPT and MMR. Please, I have a 45-minute video on this subject. And then one entitled Torn from the Land, which is what's happening to the family farmer. And then one entitled Deadly New Diseases, all these mutations and so on. So I have 4 different videotapes. Any one of those videotapes or all 4 of them, if you wish to get them, I'd like to give you a set of all 4 of my books as a gift. Now, the books themselves are worth over $35. And if you just get the videotape alone, then I'll give you a set of books with every videotape that you get. That way you'll have the total story. All you need to do is call 1-800-321-2900. Now, there are operators standing by even this late at night for about the next hour. And the number is 1-800-321-2900. I'd like to give you the books as a gift because I beg you, learn the issues. Dr. Stan is so right in what he's saying. And Dr. Stan, I need to congratulate you as a talk show host because you as talk show host are doing the greatest job of informing the American people on the truth of any group there is in this country today.
Well, this is the last means we have of reaching the people. We can't afford the television stations. Or we can't afford newspapers and magazines. You're dependent there on your advertisers, and if you offend them, they're not going to advertise with you. So, talk radio is still the last bulwark we have, and fortunately we do have supporters out across America who do help us so that we can keep doing what we're doing, and at least so far we've been able to maintain our network that we put together. So, but we just need a lot more people out there getting the information out. Are you doing quite a bit of radio today?
It's so interesting. Back during the time when the price of gasoline was going up and up and up by the day and went up to $2.30, I believe, in California at some places, I was getting radio shows almost daily. Oh, everybody was so upset. Then they took the price of gasoline back down from $2.30 a gallon to maybe $1.80 a gallon. Everybody went to sleep again. But it had been $1.50 a gallon. And now, since it went back down to $1.80, everybody thinks you're back in heaven again. And as a result, people have forgotten about the fact that it was 25 cents a gallon way back in 1964 and 65. I cannot understand why the American people can become so lackadaisical and unconcerned so quickly. But the price of that gallon of gasoline is still 30 to 40 cents a gallon higher than it was when the price started going up. It shouldn't be. In fact, it should have come down instead of going up.
Well, you know, it's amazing how people don't understand what's going on. The dollar, the American dollar, has lost about 30% of its value in relationship to the euro over the last 18 months. 30% of its value. That means, the pension funds, the bonds, the annuities, anything that is in a fixed dollar asset has lost 30% of its value in relationship to the European currency. And, of course, soon, I believe, in relationship to many other currencies. I mean, the dollar is going to be destroyed, and nobody's concerned. They can't believe it's going to happen. And, of course, our job is to make people understand what's really going on. They're just waiting for the economy to come back and, gee, it's great, the stock market's been up the last few days and last week or so. And we hear, of course, that the economy's begun to turn. But if you look and see what's really happening, more people are losing their jobs, more industries leaving America. And say what they will, manipulate it as they will, America's in real trouble. But I suppose until, what do they say? It's a recession when somebody else loses their job. It's a depression when you lose your job. And I think that an awful lot of people are going to lose everything they have. I think that the middle class is going to be impoverished before this is all over. But maybe in some ways this will be God's judgment upon America for having turned against him and for allowing these terrible things to happen. What's your impression of that concept?
Earlier in the program, you said it would be very easy to be a doomer or a gloomer. And Lindsay, do you really feel like that there is no more oil and this is doom and gloom? Quite to the contrary. I'm very encouraged by the fact that we have that oil there. We may not be allowed to take it out yet. We have the natural gas there. We may not be allowed to take that out yet. And I'm very encouraged by something else too, Dr. Stan. You know, as long as the media, news media, and the Council of Foreign Relations and others are telling the story that they're telling, they must have a platform to tell that, and they must have freedom of the press in order to be able to do it. So that means that you, as a radio talk show host, they cannot muzzle you. They can't muzzle me as an author and a person who actually saw it, because if so, then they don't have freedom of the press, so they must allow us to have the freedom of the press. And I'm very encouraged by the fact that you and I can still speak out and tell the truth. And we can tell the truth about the oil, as I'm doing it tonight. So if the worst comes to worst, it's still up there for us. I can still tell the truth about SARS, this germ that's going around over there in China right now. And my gracious, if there's ever a time that people must be concerned about their health, it's today. I can still tell the truth out here about the vaccinations, no matter how much the doctors may not like me to say it. I can still say what Dr. W.B. Clark said in Indiana, as he put it in a periodical a while back, and he said cancer was practically unknown until compulsory vaccination with cowpox vaccine began to be introduced. I have had to deal with at least 200 cases of cancer, and I never saw a case of cancer in an unvaccinated person. Oh, my goodness. I am so glad that we can still speak out and tell these facts. Yes, we're in trouble. I agree. And we're going to have some days ahead that many people may lose their jobs. But fortunately, as long as they have the right to speak out and freedom of the press, you, Dr. Stan, and I will still likewise have the same thing. Please get a copy of these books and these videotapes and learn the issues, because people say, well, what can I do? The very first thing that you can do is listen to Dr. Stan every day. Get a copy of my books and know what the issues are. Positively be able to prove and document what the issues are. Then you're a step ahead of the game.
And, Chris, I really think that although things are going to get bad, it's really what we need. Affluence can be a curse. It can make people indifferent. And maybe when things get bad, people will begin to think, will begin to evaluate what is really important. And, of course, you can go back to the history of America. America was just about on its last legs in 1730, just before the Great Awakening. But then a Great Awakening did come through Jonathan Edwards and a couple of other ministers, and America was turned around. The same thing happened in the middle 1800s, and Charles Finney led the Second Great Awakening. And just maybe there will be a third Great Awakening, and God will spare this country, and the people will return back to him. Well, I'd sort of like to get your take on the SARS epidemic, and, of course, what's this really all about? Where did SARS come from? Why does it jump the species barrier? Because ordinarily, humans don't get animal diseases, animals don't get human diseases, and yet they found this disease in the civet cats, and they found them, in the badger dog, and or maybe the raccoon job, and a dog, and some sort of a badger. Where did all this come from? And of course, why did it seem to have such lethal effects some places, and not so lethal effects elsewhere? What's your take on SARS?
I am extremely concerned about SARS. The first time that it was presented to me, I wondered where it came from. Since I have done all the investigation that I possibly can, I have even talked with those who were in Beijing at the time the outbreak took place. In fact, one of the individuals who was an American that was there when the largest hospital in Beijing, China, was closed because they were scared to death what was going to happen with the SARS spreading so rapidly. He was quarantined for a number of days. Finally made it back to America. I am led to believe that undoubtedly SARS is a man-made virus that got out of control. I'm not quite so sure that they wanted it out. I don't know that. I can't prove it either way. I do know that there was a lecture given 2 days ago in Denver, Colorado, in which the individual is one of the most, and there again I cannot name his name. The lecture was open to the public. But for the purpose of the individual, I cannot name him. And he said that SARS has already mutated into a second form. And the Center for Disease Control is extremely concerned. They had actually contacted this individual, the Center for Disease Control had, and had asked him if he knew anything that could be done about it. He lectured on this subject. And let it be known that he was extremely concerned because of the fact that this thing has mutated to another form. There are some things that have been tested by the Center for Disease Control that can help to control all of this. I don't know how to say any more because if I do, I in turn would jeopardize some people. But there is a way to protect yourself, and I would urge you to improve that immune system as rapidly as you can. Do everything in your power to allow your immune system to do it. They do not have anything in the world, in the drug world, that can take care of SARS. It will be done only by natural methods.
And, of course, so, we actually have a book by Dr. Blaylock, Russell Blaylock, and it has a whole section on how to increase your immune system in preparation for a biological attack. It doesn't matter what the organism, and the important thing is if you have a powerful immune system, you'll be able, of course, to fight that off. And there's things like quercetin and vitamin C and certainly Alamax, other products, Alamax is a garlic product, that will increase your immune response. Do you know of any other things, beta-glucans, and what else would you suggest?
Well, let me give a story that actually happened. This is in the archives of England. Back in the years when they were having the plague in Europe, the King of England heard that there were a group of men who were actually going out and robbing the graves of those who had been placed in the mass graves. But yet they weren't getting the plague. And he called them in, had them brought in before him, and he said, I'll give you one of two choices. Either tell me what you're doing to keep from getting this plague, or you're going to die. And they said, well, this is really no secret, Your Honor. They said, we are, and our forefathers are apothecaries. And that means that they use essential oils, what we call today essential oils. Now, I do not sell essential oils, but I'm just telling the story. And they said that we put this and this and this, and they named all of these different essential oils. Now, you remember that two essential oils were brought to the birth of Jesus Christ.
Frankincense and myrrh.
That's correct. So it's one of the oldest methods of increasing the immune system and oxygenating the body that there is. And they named the oils that they used, and the King of England had them put together and found out that they work. There was a person who went to the archives of England, found out what this was, put this together into a formula that they call thieves, and it's quite interesting that they would do it that way. Exactly it was back in those days. So there again, the immune system is the method of handling this. And if that immune system is strong enough, it can overcome contact with any known virus, bacteria, or fungus.
All right. Well, that's very good. Let's go to Rose calling in here. Hi, Rose. Rose from Long Island, New York. How are you tonight?
Yes, fine, thank you. I just want to tell you I'm so relieved. I mean, I listened to that program last night, and I was not... I just couldn't accept what I was hearing. And
well, you should have called in and expressed your opinion. But
well, I was trying to hint at some things when I was talking about the capped wells, you know. But today when I heard this program, I said, oh, Dr. Stan did teach me well.
Well, you never accept anything, and you have to know the background, and I have the greatest respect for Lindsay, which is why I asked him to come on tonight, so that you could hear the program last night, and that's the official party line. That's what they're telling people, and that's just what they told the Colorado legislature back in the 70s. We're running out of oil, and things are bad, and just going to get worse. And it was all part of the effort to deceive the people.
Dr. Stan, it was also the way he, when you spoke about coal, well, you'd have to convert it and this and that. You know, even if we were running out of oil, well, each different kind of resource would be used differently. So maybe coal would be heating and oil kept for this. But he was, like, changing the perspective. Well, we'd have to use all coal, or we used to have to all this. It just wasn't sitting right, whatever he was saying.
Well, I'm glad you listened tonight, then.
Yes, I am. But it's so, I said, I know I learned well from Dr. Stan, because I was getting worried yesterday.
Okay, fine. Well, thanks so much. Rose,
God
anything else you want to say?
No, thank you.
God bless you. Good
God
night.
God bless you.
All right, fine. That's Rose from Long Island, who listening to us on the Internet back there, and... we have people all across the country listening. And, of course, we're not always right, and sometimes our guests aren't always right. But when I have a question, a really serious question, I usually know somebody who's on the front lines and knows a lot more than I do and can clarify the issue. So well, is there anything else you'd like to tell us about the SARS epidemic other than we better learn about the essential oils?
Yes, the SARS epidemic is for real. I understand from certain sources that I have that there have actually been deaths in America. How far it has spread in this country, I do not know. I hope it does not go any further. It could very well turn into something more. I hope it does not. But there again, a person who knows the issues can begin now and do something about it so that if they do come in contact with it, can be protected and be safe.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I, of course, we always like to stress the importance of building up your immune system and getting all these things and having them on hand, because believe me, if there's a problem, well, you're not going to be able to run down to your local drugstore or to your health food store and get anything. So just be prepared. That's the most important thing you can do.
Well, there again, I go back to what I said a moment ago, and that is learn the issues now. While there's still an opportunity to do so, of course, naturally, I would like to push my own materials and my own books, but there again, please get my book, You Can Live. It's 260-some-odd pages. It is a full-length book. It is a library-sized book. This is not a pamphlet. This is a large library-sized book, and it will help you. Some doctors themselves, MDs, write portions in it who have stopped using the drugs and have gone to natural methods of healing. And anything, I am fully convinced that anything can be overcome by using natural methods and allowing the body's own immune system to take care of it.
Well, now, you have a very interesting video on vaccination. And, of course, there is a organized effort now all across America to pass something known as the Model Emergency Health Powers Act, or MEPA, which will require mandatory vaccinations. And, of course, I think this is a very, very dangerous thing. And I know that you are very much against vaccinations as well. Let's see. Somebody's asking a question here, and it's being typed up on the screen. Is there a good supply of oil in Israel? Do you know anything at all? Have you heard anything about oil in Israel?
I have read some articles on that. I have not talked with people who have actually drilled over there. I do understand that they have found something, or they think they found something. It very well could be that there is a great supply of oil in Israel. They have actually gone back to the scriptures and found in the scriptures where there was supposed to be oil in a certain spot. And I understand that they are drilling at this time.
All right, fine. But I think we'll just have to wait and see what happens. I will tell you one thing, and that is that you always just have to be a little skeptical when, you know, when the big boys go in and the big major corporations go in, they go in because they know that there's going to be oil there, or got a pretty good idea of it. When small people go in, you know that they can't get the big people to go in because the big people don't believe it's there. Somebody once told me that, you know, when somebody comes to an average individual and wants them to invest in this great idea they have, it's really because it's not a very great idea, because it was a good idea. They go to people with a lot of money that recognize it, that give them all the money they want. So just be wary. When they come to you, you have to ask, why are they going to me rather than the big boys who are really pretty, a lot smarter than I am? Advice has been very, very profitable to me through the years, so I don't believe everything that I'm told. And you shouldn't either. And you shouldn't even believe everything you hear on Radio Liberty. Think about it and check it out. Now, let's talk just a little bit about the vaccinations, because your video certainly paints a very dreary picture of vaccinations.
Vaccinations, I think every parent, before they allow that child to be vaccinated, should at least learn the issues. I'm not saying don't vaccinate your child. That's your decision. That is your child. And it doesn't belong to the doctor or the nurse either. But please know the issues. Dr. W.B. Clark said in an article the following: cancer was practically unknown until compulsory vaccination. Well, let's see. I think I gave that one a moment ago, didn't I? Or did I give that?
Yes, no, you did. But
yeah,
certainly, this cancer has just increased dramatically over the last century.
Yes. Dr. Dennis Turnbull stated in a medical periodical, he said that he had studied cancer for over 30 years. I have no hesitation in stating that, in my judgment, the most frequent disposing condition of cancerous development is infused into the body by vaccination and revaccination. Know the issues on vaccinations. Dr. Charles Page of Boston stated, injection of virus into a pure bloodstream of people does not prevent disease. Rather, it tends to increase its epidemics and make the disease more deadly. Of this, we have indisputable proof. In our country, cancer mortality has increased 900% within the past 50 years, and no conceivable thing could have caused this but the universal blood poisoning now existing in vaccinations. Now, I was able to get some doctors to actually state their case on vaccinations, and as a result, I produced a 45-minute tape that will inform every mother as to what the dangers are, what can be caused, what can happen if you don't vaccinate your child, and what can happen if you do vaccinate your child. You definitely need to know the issues, and even grandparents. A man called me the other day from over in Nevada, and he said, my daughter is about to have a baby. Please get me your vaccination video as quick as you can. I want to at least let them know the issues so that they can make up their mind what they want to do.
Well, the idea of giving them that hepatitis B vaccine while the child is still in the nursery, I think, is criminal.
Well,
that
yes.
is just totally uncalled for. And these other vaccines that have the thimerosal in them, and then they have the audacity to put in the Office of Homeland Security legislation a stipulation that you can't sue the manufacturer of thimerosal. Come on now. If there's nothing to worry about, why are they trying to protect them? If there is something to worry about, why are they have they put it in for so many years? And they knew the thimerosal wasn't safe, and they knew it was toxic to the brains, and they put it in there anyway.
Yes. In fact, I have in front of me the sheet of paper that comes out of the bottle that the doctors receive in the box with the DPT shot. And, of course, the first ingredient is formaldehyde. that's embalming fluid. And then the one that you just mentioned, trimerosal and sodium chloride and then nitric acid and then charcoal and then sheep's blood as a culture medium. What thinking parent would dare want to put? You need to know from the doctor's standpoint themselves, such as they give it. You actually see the doctor in this videotape that I produced tell why they stopped giving vaccinations and why they won't give them anymore.
Well, I think that parents really need to be informed, and it's so vitally important because you don't get a second chance. Now, some children, of course, take the vaccines with no difficulty at all. But, of course, the incidence of autism has gone from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 250, and some places 1 in 150. Are you willing to take the chance with results like that? And, of course, when you see an autistic child, of course, not only the child's life devastated, but the family as well. And so understand what the risks are and weigh the risk-benefit ratio, and then you make the decision. But understand that no doctor is going to give you a Stein slip saying that he will be responsible for your child if there's a complication from the vaccination. And certainly the vaccine manufacturers won't either. In fact, they have legislation enacted so that you cannot sue a vaccine manufacturer.
Yes, and it's very encouraging and very pleasing to be on the air tonight on your show with a talk show host who is so informed. And, of course, you, I believe, are a doctor yourself.
Yes, I was. I was an orthopedic surgeon, and I'll have to admit, I wasn't very smart until I got out of and began reading this material. And, of course, I got a peripheral neuritis myself after taking what I was assured was a completely harmless hepatitis B vaccine. And nobody ever told me, and no place did I ever read, the number of complications that came with that specific vaccine because of molecular mimicking and because it attacks the nervous system. So there's a lot we have to learn. We're just about out of time. Lindsay, do you have a parting thought for our listeners?
I sure do. And I thank you for letting me say just a final word, and that is know the issues. That's the greatest thing you can possibly do. Learn. Read everything you can. Listen to Dr. Stan. And then once you know the issues, then you can take action knowledgeably, intelligently, and know exactly what to do. So it's a privilege to be on here with Dr. Stan and be allowed to be on your show tonight. Honestly, I say it because it's so good to have a talk show. And you're so fortunate, those who are out there in the listening audience, that have a talk show host like this that you can listen to day after day.
Well, let's get that telephone number out just one more time where people can call and get your books.
All four of my books is a gift. Any one of the videotapes that you get or more of them, 800. They're on the line right now. They'll be glad to take your call even this late at night. 800-321-2900. 800-321-2900.
And believe me, that's a great deal. Thank you very so much for being with us, Lindsay. And I recommend the books to all the listeners. Good night. May the Lord be with you. Bye-bye. Okay, fine. Well, it's Lindsay William, and of course, once again, let me remind you, Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you'd like to become part of the Radio Liberty family, give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because we are at war. America truly is under attack today. And so, until Monday, when we'll be back with you, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you.